Good morning. I wish I could change my name to the name of Frank Gravel. Frank Gravel has a very important first name, Frank. That maybe he and I will try to have in common with Frank Gravel. I want to be frank also this morning, very frank with you. I came here. And I was very happy to come here on the 8th of October 2002. And it was at that time that I requoted a man whom we all like so much here in this room, and that is Donald Rumsfeld, who said, and it sounded so good, and the media picked it up, "Absence of evidence is no evidence of absence." Well, he was correct to some extent. Indeed, in 2002, there was no evidence that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. But there was also evidence at that time that there was no link between Iraq, Al-Qaeda, and weapons of mass destruction. And in the area which has been so fateful to me as an individual, economic sanctions in Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, there was plenty of evidence at the time that United Nations Security Council policies were indeed responsible for the destruction of a whole nation. And there was already plenty, as there is today and as there was in 1990-91, daily evidence to you, to me, of the weapon of mass deception, no question. The media, and I have to be very careful, not because there are media sitting here who could now take objection. There is media and media, but a lot of the powerful media in our world deceived, because they had the knowledge. There was a psycho war. There were millions and millions of dollars spent by public relations firms such as Hill, Knowles, and Rendon. Ray McGovern will know better than I do what went on in the US in terms of fostering this psycho war. Today, there is not only evidence, there is conclusive evidence that in all these years there was no link between weapons of mass destruction, Al-Qaeda, and Iraq. There are, or were, in the later days of the 90s, no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And there is plenty of evidence of the deep and pervasive damage that has been done under 13 long years of sanctions. And now, there's new evidence. Evidence of the impact of an illegal war, evidence of the tremendous insecurity that prevails now in this in Iraq. And if you are interested, there is a recent report put out by a Belgian team of doctors. Well, if you look at that report, you want to be very humble, because what we thought were problems in the years of sanctions after the war, the situation in Iraq hasn't improved at all, despite of what you may read at times in the newspaper about water supply, about electricity, about food. I think the brutal truth is that acute malnutrition is on the rise, electricity has deteriorated further, the water and sanitation situation is very poor. Let's say I'm wrong on all of this. One thing is very clear. It's a nation under psychological trauma now. I talk regularly to Iraqis. I see them in Geneva. I speak to Baghdad, to Basra, and to other places. I think it's a nation, an all-pervasive trauma has landed on the shoulders of man, woman, and child in that country. And I can only agree with what Foreign Minister Stieg Möller said on the 6th of September 2002, when he did say here in Copenhagen, evidence must be able to stand up in the Copenhagen Municipal Court. He is so right. Evidence must stand up in any court, whether a Danish court or a European court or an Iraqi court. The issue of war here or peace here, I think evidence is vital. Without evidence, we cannot take a responsible political decision. And what we now have to say to ourselves as citizens of a Europe that wants to get together more closely is that the European coalition partners, I do not want to be disrespectful to Denmark, but Denmark is included here. The European coalition partners ignored, ladies and gentlemen, that evidence. And the impact of sanctions, the lack of the Iraqi threat. It would be presumptuous on my part to be here accusatory to a government. I'm just an individual, a single individual who by fate was assigned to Iraq as the humanitarian coordinator. But as a citizen of Europe, I want to say that my expectation was that the Danish government, the foreign policy of Denmark, would be based, ladies and gentlemen, on evidence. And it wasn't. And as a former United Nations official, I also want to say, I'm not flattering you. I've said this before, but I want to say it again because I believe in this. Denmark, Scandinavia, to me, as a United Nations official, was a model for responsible political behavior in the 1990s when I, and 80s and 70s and 60s when I served in the United Nations. The United Nations reports show that year after year, Denmark had the highest standard of material and non-material life. All major international human rights instruments you have signed. You have been a very generous donor and participants in the international development discussion. Denmark has been truly internationally minded. And therefore, a decision by Denmark in March 2003 to join the US and UK war coalition came to many of us, to you, to me, as a very deep shock, given the lack of evidence that prevailed about the threat, given the fact that here was an instrument you helped to create, the United Nations Security Council, that was against this preemptive war, given the fact that colleagues of mine, known in Scandinavia much better than many of us here, like Dr. Hans Blix, Dr. El-Baradei, they begged, they wanted a little bit more time in order to preserve a peaceful solution. And yet, all of that was thrown out of the window by the coalition, which included the government of Prime Minister Rasmussen. This hearing is, for me, another wonderful expression of democracy. But you are the public. Where are the political decision makers? Are we so little? Are we so insignificant that they cannot give us this moment of time to discuss, in the spirit of democracy, issues that are so vital about peace or war, about the fact whether we want to make preemptive conflict resolution through wars as part of our international toolkit? I don't think that the politicians who should sit here should come to the conclusion that you and I and people up here are just a group of blue-eyed activists. We are not. I think it should be accepted that we are very strong in our public rejection of the Iraq approach by Denmark and by others. The war and the immense destruction that has followed, the current iron fist approach with all the trauma that comes out of this, we reject this. And I believe, and I'm sure you believe, that realpolitik is not the reserve of any government. I think the Iraq debate of the public in Europe has shown much more foresight, much more legal-mindedness, and most significantly, much more humanity than any of the governments of the day, including, and I'm not here hateful or revengeful or extremist, the government of Mr. Rasmussen. Terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, the war of 2003, 13 years of sanctions. We must not allow to have these four issues mixed into a cocktail that is a cocktail of political convenience and cover-up. There is simply no black and white picture, and we have to recognize this. And all the four issues that I've referred to must be looked first and foremost as issues of their own. I would say the issue of weapons of mass destruction and the imminent threat, Mr. Blix, Mr. El Baradei, have clarified. I certainly could not do it any better. They have done a very convincing piece of work to show there was no imminency of threat. And in what stark contrast is this to the statement of Mr. Rasmussen on the 19th of February 2003, just before, a few weeks before the war was carried out, when he said in the in this parliament here, we know he, Saddam Hussein, has these weapons of mass destruction. War, the second point, war was not, absolutely not an ultima ratio. It wasn't the last alternative. There were peaceful alternatives. And the United Nations Security Council had maybe an hour of, we call it a Sternstunde in German, a very special moment of enlightenment when they refused this war resolution. Economic sanctions, the third issue, another form of war. We know now death, and it brought death and destruction. What you may not know, but which was for me a daily concern, a daily issue, the Oil for Food program was totally inadequate response. It was a very poor leaf, fig leaf, of conscience of the international community. And I cannot understand how Gitte Seeberg could say from the Danish Conservative Party, how she could say in 2002, there's no reason to change the Danish sanction policy. If Iraqi people want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, they should do it themselves. They couldn't do it themselves. It wasn't possible. We all know, we don't need to discuss, that Saddam Hussein was always on the other side of the boundary. But it wasn't Saddam Hussein, the dictator. It was the United Nations Security Council that crossed the boundary. Mr. Saddam Hussein was always on that other side of the boundary. We joined internationally Saddam Hussein as an ally in becoming illegal. The sanctions, the war of 1991, whether we like wars or not, from an international legal point of view, was legal. A country that invades another country must be taken to task. So what started out in 1991 was not illegal. The sanctions were legal. But the collateral damage, the violation of international law, that That boundary was very quickly crossed from what was an acceptable, morally, with some difficulty, defendable damage under sanctions, became a violation of international law. And Denmark and other governments in Europe knew this very well. They knew that we had crossed this boundary. And the same illegality prevailed with regard to the issue you know about, the no-fly zones. The no-fly zones were also illegal. These four issues, terrorism, the terrorists, of course, have to be taken to task. The question is, what is a terrorist? That's a different discussion. I just wanted to say, but here are terrorists. Here is terrorism, and terrorism has to be understood in its causes. President Gorbachev in Mexico just a few weeks ago, he said it so well that I just want to quote it because I can't say it better. He said, the roots of terrorism, one has to remember, involve also the humiliation of whole nations and cultures which have suffered from years of injustice. And here, ladies and gentlemen, is that red threat before the war, during the war, and after the war. The red threat which I would like to identify consists to me out of three elements. One is this fatal and misinformation that has been thrown at us day after day. And for a public, whether in Denmark or in Germany or in the US or in Britain, it was very difficult to understand the real situation of weapons of mass destruction, economic sanctions, the imminence of threat, number one. Number two, the red thread, the violation of international law, the sanctions that became illegal, the no-fly zones that were illegal, the war that was illegal. And I want to add here something which we must, the peace movement, must focus on more than we have done, and that is the fate of the detainees. It isn't enough to talk about Guantanamo. We also must talk about Baghdad. There are detainees. There are people held for over a year now without a charge, in fairly miserable conditions, as we can ascertain. The third element, and maybe the most significant one, if you know what is happening and you don't change your policies, then intent comes in. And when intent comes in, the step towards culpability, towards illegal behavior, isn't a big one. And I would say, and I hope I'm not going to be challenged on this, accountability is for everybody, is for the strong as much as for the weak. And I would say the Iraq policy that we have seen up to March 2003, then the illegal war, then the post-war approach. A former British Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, said, is an inexhaustible recruiting ground for anti-war terrorism. I think this alone should worry us a lot. And when General Kimmich, the military spokesman in Baghdad of the CPA, of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and Mr. Rumsfeld keep referring to those who risk their lives in Iraq today to protest against an illegal occupation as thugs and criminals, they do not understand the reality of the situation in Iraq at all. It's a tragic misrepresentation. It is becoming every day, ladies and gentlemen, more a civil uprising and nothing less. And what is needed now are bold changes in the European Union and in member countries in the wake of this deep and deepening Iraq tragedy. Before the war, Mr. Prodi said, there can be no role for the European Union in Iraq without common foreign policy. Well, that holds today as much as it did then. The European position on Iraq, the development of such a position, is urgent. The European position to deal with international conflicts of this kind is urgent. We must broaden all the good initiatives that started in Stockholm, in Berlin, in Bonn, and in Interlaken, these four countries or four cities that talked about smarter approaches to these sanction issues. That has to be broadened. And the European Parliament and member countries like Denmark and my own country, Germany, must become active. This inaction, the silence these days. Why are our political leaders so silent? Why is the German Chancellor, Mr. Chirac, so silent? Is the transatlantic relationship more important than the lives and the legality of the situation in Iraq? I don't think so. There should be high-level visits to Iraq. They're not photo ops visits, not visits so that Mr. Berlusconi can say, I have eaten a hamburger with the troops. No, that's not what we want. We would like bold political initiatives of a much more serious nature than that. And finally, I'm coming to my end now here. Denmark, no doubt, is a highly respected member, I said this already, of the global community. What an act of statesmanship it would be if Denmark were to accept that the evidence of a flawed policy before war, the illegal war, and the aftermath, if Denmark would accept that and show that it is human rights minded beyond its borders, not just within Denmark, that Denmark could show leadership for responsible change in Europe. What choice, ladies and gentlemen, what choice do we really have in the end? Well, we have the choice as a global community between military muscle, imperial self-interest, and this horrible moral absolutism that is leading to what? It is leading to a deepening, not to a lessening, of the global conflict. And the other side, the other choice we have, is instead of military muscle, to show some intellectual muscle and to show some humanity as steps first, small but important steps towards a global healing process. And that's really what I wanted to convey to you. But before I have one last second, I think and I sense, looking at you and discussing with my colleague Jan and friend Jan Oberg, I think we owe it, in my view, to the Iraqi people that we just for one moment, just 1 minute, are silent. Let us be silent for just 1 minute to respect the Iraqi people. Thank you. Thank you.
There will now be questions from the two brilliant journalists on both of my sides. Who want to begin?
You you said that the UN palaces were responsible for a huge amount of devastation of Iraqi society, which we have all witnessed during these 13 years. I would like to ask you how you would describe the responsibility of the Saddam regime concerning not getting the sanction lifted during 13 years. Was there really nothing that the regime could do?
It's a weakness on my part that I keep emphasizing sanctions. When I said there is no black and white picture, of course, one has to put a lot of blame on the shoulders of Saddam Hussein and his government. But if I were to go into details now, you would come to the conclusion that I'm an apologist for Saddam Hussein. I'm not. But I want to discuss with ourselves those aspects over which we had a choice. Mr. Saddam Hussein, I said, was already on the other side of the boundary. We went to join him. I give you one example. Why, when the Oil for Food program was first introduced, why was only the equivalent of $113 per person per year, $113 per person per year for everything, from water, sanitation, electricity, food, education, medicines? $113 was what the UN Security Council put at the disposal of the Iraqis. Why? We had choices. We could have given a much larger amount. Why did the UN Security Council never exercise its oversight mandate? They should have gone. They should have seen. They should have encouraged us to report on the human condition. Instead, I, as the senior official in Baghdad, was asked to account for the medicines that came in, the food that had arrived, but not to describe the human condition. So the United Nations became a tool, a very brutally misused tool. This is not being anti-American at all, by the way, of an American government that used the United Nations for its own bilateral political ends. That's what concerns me. What Saddam Hussein did will and is documented, will be more documented, is also, by the way, often very much conspiratorial, because we don't have the facts. We will have more facts, but we don't have conclusive facts. And I take it as given that there is a brutal dictator who has done a lot of harm against his people. But next to the chair in a court of justice must be his chair, must be some other chairs. We had a choice, and we chose to ignore, for political reasons, this collateral damage, as it is called, and inflict so much misery on the Iraqi people. Sorry, I can't give you a good answer, but eventually there has to be that balance. But I am comfortable in portraying to you the choices we had, which we did not exercise. We didn't choose these alternatives that were available.
But what were these alternatives? You said that there could be a peaceful solution with the Saddam regime. Which kind of peace would be possible with the Saddam regime, which also meant a peace for the Iraqi people?
Well, there weren't just a few, there were many. There are experts in this room who can answer better what choices there were in the area of disarmament. But even there, Dr. Blix and Dr. Al-Baradei asked for more time with his 300 people. And 1,700 people, 1,600 experts with Dr. K after the war asked for more time. So here was one alternative. One could have gone down this road to war or this road towards a peaceful disarmament process. As far as the comprehensive economic sanctions are concerned, give me one good reason why there was this link between disarmament, which was the job of the government of Saddam Hussein, and economic sanctions, which was an issue for the people. Mr. Saddam Hussein did not suffer from economic sanctions. It was 22 million, 23 million Iraqis who suffered. So there was an alternative. There was an alternative in the financing. There was an immense alternative in making sure that humanitarian goods were coming more easily into Iraq. I discovered in a very careful review that it took 23 different steps to get a glass that Iraq wanted to import from Copenhagen to Baghdad. 23 different steps. It involved the Defense Department, involved the Foreign Ministry, it involved your mission to the UN, it involved the Banque Nationale de Paris with the financing, it involved the supplier, it involved a clearing agent in Switzerland. 23 different steps. Why? In the beginning, one could have argued this was experimentation. We didn't have a knowledge, because no country, you must remember, has ever been subjected to such comprehensive economic sanctions. So when, after the beginning, one could see the impact of international policy on the life of people in Iraq, then one should have changed. There was no change. And why was there no change? I think we could have done everything that was asked for in the books of the United Nations. Nothing would have changed as long as Saddam Hussein was in power. That was the ultimate objective. And in the beginning, it was hidden. Later on, in the Clinton administration already, it became much more open, because the Iraq Liberation Act of October 1998 made it clear that the declared policy of the Clinton administration was the removal of Saddam Hussein. And as long as this didn't happen, the people could suffer. The people are expendable. Never mind about the people. What is more important is that politically we are retaining the upper hand.
Okay, it's my turn now. Mr. von Spanek, I think everybody can agree that a lot of policies on Iraq have been flawed. Time after time, mistakes have been made. But let's not dwell so much on the past, but rather on the present. You opened up by stating that the humanitarian situation in Iraq now is far worse than even during the time of the sanctions. I'm not sure that everybody will agree with you on this. I hear very different reports also from inside Iraq, but surely everybody can agree that the reconstruction effort has not been as successful as it was hoped for. But who is to blame for this? I mean, on one hand, we do have a lot of resources pouring in and a lot of efforts to rebuild infrastructure, etc. And on the other hand, we have this civil uprising, which you call it, which has been largely responsible for sabotage and for hampering the reconstruction effort. So who is to blame and what is the solution? I mean, would you suggest that foreign troops should pull out and leave Iraq in the hands of this civil uprising in order to undertake reconstruction and create a democracy inside Iraq? Is that a realistic proposal?
Well, thank you. That's a challenging question, and I can assure you that I don't want to overstate the case. But when you talk to psychiatrists who have been in Iraq, when you talk, as I do, two or three times a week to different people, contacts, friends in Iraq, when you talk to the delegations, for example, right now is an Iraqi delegation in Geneva attending the Human Rights Commission. When you talk to all these, then you get not an identical assessment. You do hear that there are pockets of progress. But one thing, there seems to be agreement, And I use this in my statement. It is a nation in shock. It's a traumatized nation. There's hardly a family that isn't affected. When my son, my second son went to Baghdad 2 weeks before the war, went back to Baghdad 2 weeks after the war, to bring together American students and Iraqi students in a video conference. When he came back, there was a universal statement from the Iraqi students of fear, of real, genuine fear to be on the street, to go to school, and this is Baghdad. But when I spoke to the bishop of Basra not long ago, the same picture. So maybe I overstated it. Maybe there are some people that are better off, but the majority of the people, taking everything into account that I know, including the Belgian doctor's report of March of this year, it looks as if it is a nation in deep shock. And when you say, let's not look too much at the past, let's look at the present, I'm glad you didn't say future, because then I would have been a little bit red in my face. We cannot look to the future responsibly without understanding the past and also the present. What is the solution? If you had asked me this 3/4 of a year ago, my answer would have been much easier. With the chaos that is evolving now, and so much speculation by outsiders, including myself, it's very difficult to come with to give you a clear answer. One approach surely has to be to argue that this illegal war, what illegal it was, the security after the war is the responsibility of the occupying forces. But there is absolutely no reason, nor is there any justification, that the CPA under Mr. Bremer continues to call the shots on the civilian side. It is untenable that Mr. Bremer goes to Amman and represents Iraq in an economic summit. It is untenable that it is the CPA leadership that decides on contracts. There should be a division of labor, security, the occupation forces, reconstruction and development, national reconstruction should go to the Iraqis, assisted by the United Nations. If they want to get out of this quagmire, this dilemma, then they have to do that division and give Iraqis the right to formulate and implement their national reconstruction program and invite the international community to join them. The first fiddle must be played by Iraqis, not by us. We can assist, but it mustn't be an American-led approach on how to reconstruct Iraq. That would be one small input on my part into this discussion about what solution could there be. But as the situation now deteriorates from day to day, we have now the first murder of a foreign worker, as you have heard this morning, the Italian who was killed. This will get worse. So it's very hard. Mr. Lakhdar Brahimi will have an impossible task right now in Baghdad. Security is number one. Once the security is there, and that is the responsibility of the occupation forces, only then can we talk about approaches of the kind that I try to identify.
From the floor, it seems so. In this side, please.
Hello, my name is John Goodwin. I'm a political student. Pernille Barming, your question, what kind of peace is possible with the Iraqi regime seemed to imply that the United States was interested in negotiating some kind of a peace with the Iraqi regime. I don't believe that that was the case. They had, what they were working towards was regime change. They weren't interested in negotiating a peace with the existing regime. This, I believe, was an article of law in the United States of America, and I invite Mr. Sponek or maybe Mr. McGovern, they can correct me if that's not the case. And your first question about the Iraqi regime's own culpability with regard to the oil for food program that I think reflects a relatively widespread myth that if the Iraqis had simply chosen to cooperate with the United Nations weapons inspectors, that those sanctions would have been called off. And again, that is a misunderstanding. And I believe that this has been commented on several times by the United States government. And again, I invite the panel to contradict me if that's not the case. But there's just a few misunderstandings that I thought kind of lay in your questions the way you asked them.
My name is Solvay Dupont. I would like to tell that Mr. von Sponeck's input to solution is translated in the paper who is on the table after this 11 points you have stated.
Yeah, my name is Frederik Schack, and I would like to know the name of this Belgian report.
Okay. Yeah, it's very simple. The author, the principal author, is Dr. Van Morten, M-O-O-R-T-E-N, and I can, if you give me your email address, I can give you the exact way of getting it, okay? It's March 2004. It's a very recent document.
Well, I have a question to Mr. Hans von Sponeck. You said that we should use more intellectual muscles and more humanity, perhaps even more humility, to start a global healing process. Could you, as a dig a little more deeper into it and come with some suggestions how we could do that in practice? Because I think many of us in the peace movement, we do try to do the things we're talking about, but perhaps you have some really good new ideas.
We have a question from Willy Søndal, member of the Danish Parliament, and I am sorry to say that we'll have to stop here and go further on. And those who didn't get the chance now to put their question, please come back. There will be chances after each presentation. So, Willy Søndal.
I'll not stay to the past. I'll say very little about the future, the present, but I have a question about the future. Your final remark was that what beautiful step if Denmark would say the evidence lacked, we were wrong, we are sorry. That's not possible with the Danish Prime Minister. I mean, he doesn't function that way. So my question is, how do we get further? I see two possibilities. The present situation worsening every day up to the 30th of June, and after that worsening probably even more. And the second scenario, to find those steps, which countries are the ones who would stand in the front and say, we are sorry, we were wrong? Which countries do you see standing in that row very soon? I mean, the Spanish election, Kwasniewski, the Polish governor, saying he was he got wrong information. The Philippines, I saw yesterday on their way out, the Ukrainians on their way out, the Bulgarians. How many do you think needs to go back before US will recognize that for reasons that we are getting very lonely, we have to find another way? And which other possible way would it be thinkful that the present administration would take?
And now the last answers, please. Yeah.
I just want to say, in fairness to you, maybe we can talk about it in the hallway if there's no time now. But I think what, no, I don't mean you. I mean the lady behind you. Because what you raised is important. As far as what you said, of course, I knew very well that this would be the reaction. Neither Mr. Bush nor Mr. Rasmussen will ever stand before the global community and say, mea culpa, I'm sorry, we did the wrong thing. But what prevents the European Union as a collective entity to get together and make a statement that signals that we as human beings and as politicians have an ability to observe, to change, and not be as rigid as we see a president in Washington these days behaving. And then there is a chance. A Denmark alone, a France alone, a Germany alone will not make a difference. The difference will be made by our collective rethinking and our intervention in the situation in the Middle East. What prevents us as a European Union to go to Cairo and go to Dr. Amir Moussa and talk to the Secretary General of the Arab League, try to jointly prop ourselves up a bit and develop a common approach? Silence, to me, is cowardice. It's the worst we can do right now. This is morally and politically unacceptable. And when you talk about countries, yes, I think the Spanish Prime Minister has courage. The Philippine president is afraid. It's different. She's afraid that some of her nationals may die. But the Spanish Prime Minister wanted to change policy. That's what we are looking for. And this is what I think has to happen in the context of the European Union. But I still want to say, and I think I'm here, I'm sure that I have some support for this naiveness. But I want to be naive. It's good to be naive. If you are naive, you are single-minded and you can focus on something. I want to say we all would lead a more encouraged life if one of our political leaders would say, I was wrong. What a fantastic response that would be in a democracy. It will not happen. It will not happen. But we should not be shy in demanding that it happens. That's all.